This is Red Ice Radio. From the apparent to the esoteric. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome to Red Ice Radio 2012. Here we go. My name is Henrik. It's good to have you with us. Thank you for stopping by wherever you're from. We are coming to you from the west of Sweden in Scandinavia. In case you don't know it, RedIceCreations.com. That's the website where you can go to hear, see and read much more of the material that we present. Today we have William Henry back with us on the program to discuss 2012, The Secret of Sion, his latest book and the DVD, The Light of Sion. From Nashville, Tennessee, William is an internationally renowned investigative mythologist. He is the author of 16 books and numerous DVD programs, and is a contributor to the History Channel's popular series, Ancient Aliens. The Secret of Sion represents the culmination of William's unique search in Gnostic literature and sacred art that maps the path called the Way of Light that leads to the Gate of Heaven. His quest led him through the wormhole, where he peered into the Promised Land of Sion, a place at the center of a galaxy that is inhabited by ascended humans. Stay with us for much more. Welcome back to Red Ice Radio, William Henry. Thank you for coming on. It's good to talk to you once again, William. How are you today?
Very well, Henrik. Thank you for having me back on the show. It's good to talk with you.
Absolutely. You bet. We have some interesting things lined up. And recently, William, by the way, on the show, we talked about 2012. We had an issue in terms of trying to see this from both angles, trying to see it from something bad happening, and we're going to try with you tonight as well to try to get to the aspect of seeing this from a positive point of view. There's so many theories, there's so many things of this, and I don't want to get stuck obviously to 2012 per se, but we are entering into it here in just a few days basically, and we have a lot of anticipation happening and so forth, and obviously, William, it does tie into your work in terms of stargates, in terms of openings, if you will, of both you know, spiritual and physical energy. So overall though, what's your view now a few days away? What do you think, William?
Well, there is so much tabloid and fear-based information out there. You've got some so-called 2012 experts that can't tell the difference between the Mayan calendar and the Aztec sunstone, and they're telling us that it's going to be this way and that way. And personally, I just try to go back to some of the original thinkers on the 2012 question, John Major Jenkins, Terence McKenna, people such as this that don't have a glamour aspect of it. They're not playing guru. They're not trying to pretend that they know what's going to happen, doom or bloom. And so I just go back to that original research and say there's no question that we are experiencing a shift of the ages, a change in the calendar, and in fact the end of the Mayan calendar. I mean, that is an actual established fact. Everything on top of that then becomes a matter of personal opinion, and it becomes more of a, in my view, somewhat of a psychological test than anything. What you're saying about 2012 is actually what you think about yourself. And we're finding, something that's really shocked me actually, Henrik, is that, I mean, I have called out a couple of researchers who don't have their facts straight. And I've actually been attacked by their followers and fans for even questioning the veracity of what some of these people are saying. And what I've kind of learned from this is that people really don't care, fact or fiction. They just want it to be what they want it to be.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter. So that's kind of I'm not trying to say I'm bitter about it or throwing in a towel or anything, but it's just been kind of shocking to me to see that happen when we have clearly established, at least since 2003, when I first started writing about 2012 and started conversing with John Major Jenkins about some of the Maya symbolism and their obsession with star knowledge. And we have, in that interim, so much has happened that seems to validate what the Mayans were saying, that I think we have to agree that clearly things are shifting and changing.
That's right. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, many people their mind is made up, so they don't want to have any time to debate intelligently about the issue. So, I mean, from my point of view, why even bother, you know, taking the time then to respond back? Because, frankly, an unintelligent attack in that sense doesn't deserve an intelligent response, if you will.
Yeah, I agree. And especially, I mean, in one instance, I was just simply trying to defend my original research where a researcher, a well-known 2012 quote-unquote authority had, I think, in a way, mischaracterized my research about the dome of the U.S. Capitol. He took people up into the dome and showed them Montezuma and Cortez in this scene that's painted in the dome of the U.S. Capitol and pointed to the Aztec sunstone and said, "There it is, friends, the Mayan calendar, proof that the founding fathers of America knew about 2012 and everything is set up for 2012. Well, the problem was, as I said, he was pointing at the Aztec sunstone, which has a correlation to the Mayan calendar, but is not the same thing. It's kind of like pointing at the national flag of Sweden and saying it's the flag of the United States. They're both flags. They both represent a country, but that's about as far as it goes. And when I went on to suggest that, hey, we as 2012 researchers have to get our facts straight. We have to know what we're talking about, because if we don't, we're going to get hammered by the critics out there who think we're all a bunch of know-nothings. And again, what happened is his followers came back on me saying, how dare you question this researcher? He is infallible. And this attack on him is something we don't really care for you to be doing. And I'm just like going, hey guys, I'm just trying to defend my original research, my original hard-earned research, and to keep it factual, because if nothing else, we have to at least keep it factual, try to be as truth-telling as we possibly can, because that's the only way we're going to get through this period.
Well, that's right, and there is a lot of confusion around where 2012 shows up. We have the monument in Puerto Guerra, of course, and then now recently, allegedly, I haven't seen this yet, William, but the new latest news, I guess, from Comalcalco, if I pronounced that correct, a ruin where they allegedly found another inscription that seems to be pointing towards 2012 as well. I guess you have to make the conversions obviously from the Mayan dates and over to our latest version, if you will, our Gregorian calendar, to end up there. But why is it? I mean, the Aztec stone calendar that you mentioned, that, according to you now, what you're saying then, is not related to 2012 directly. Is that correct?
It does not encode the 2012 end date. It does describe the shift of the ages, but it is totally erroneous to identify it as the Mayan calendar. It is not.
Yeah.
But it does encode the shift of the ages and does correlate, as does the Aztec, the Mixtec, the Mayan, and the Olmec. They all kind of share from the same tradition. But 99.5% of the time, when a 2012 guy is talking about the Mayan calendar, they're going to show a picture of the Aztec sunstone. They do it on TV all the time, and the so-called experts do it, and it's wrong. And all I'm saying is, hey, if you're going to talk about the Mayan calendar, at least show the Mayan calendar and don't talk about the Aztec sunstone and equate them. Again, they do share an underlying basis and they do correspond, but the Aztec sunstone does not identify December 21st, 2012 as a Mayan end date. Only the Mayan calendar stone does that. And so that's just an important distinction. And so when this person takes you up to the Dome of the Capitol and says, there it is, proof the founding fathers of the United States knew about 2012, they did not. I mean, I wish they did. I am an expert on their symbolism, and he was using my source material. And this is kind of why I went on the defensive about it, because I didn't want people to think that I didn't know the difference between the Aztec sunstone and the Mayan calendar, because I do. And I did not make any connection with the founding fathers in 2012 because there isn't one. And the response was from this author, well, that's just a technicality. People believe that this is the way it is, so therefore it is. And that's kind of the other point I was making here, Henrik, is that people seem to just want to believe something, and in believing it makes it true. And that's one of the kind of curiosities of our time. It's fascinating that the way that that's happening, that people just decide that this is the way it is and that's the way it's going to be. So that's fine.
That's right. They throw around the term truth and they mix it up with their own belief. Ain't that true, you know, in that sense? But obviously, the 2012, William, it's a node point, if you will. We have a lot going on for this year, and as we'll get into some of the information here, that is pertinent to your new book, The Secret of Sion, and obviously the new DVD that goes hand in hand with that, The Light of Sion. I just want to run this by you, since we have this connection going on here now. There was a very interesting researcher who passed away a few years ago now that we had with us, a young man, Rick Clay, and he, among other people, were detailing what was going on in terms of the 2012 Olympics in London, and connected the symbolism, obviously, of the logo to decoding this into Sion, but not the word Sion that you use with an S, S-I-O-N. This is the word Z-I-O-N, Zion. First of all, have you heard about that, and can you comment if so on that? And then later maybe we can talk about the distinction, if there is such a thing, between these two words, William.
Well, the word is sometimes spelled with a Z, so Sion, S-I-O-N, and Zion, Z-I-O-N, are the same word. It means peace. It gave its name to the mountain in Jerusalem. It's also, as we can talk about, the name for the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and as I'm proposing, is home to a race of advanced beings. And again, we'll get into that. But no, I have not seen that decoding of the 2012 Olympics logo. I have been paying close attention, though, to the symbolism of the London 2012 Olympics ever since 2003, again, in my conversations with John Major Jenkins. I've been studying the Maya symbolism relative to 2012, and one of the key components of this symbolism is what they call a serpent rope, which is a sort of cosmic umbilical cord that their god beings are believed to have traveled through. The picture you get from the Maya cosmology and their symbolism, as John established, is that we might be talking, in fact, about not a serpent rope, but rather a stargate or a wormhole. And this would be a key feature of the 2012 symbolism, something that has certainly been borne out, because as you look around our culture, in our movies, in our TV, in our commercials, in our consciousness, we have now fully established this idea of interdimensional travel, travel via stargate, travel via wormhole. So you go over to the 2012 Olympics, and they're building this massive new tower, which is going to be the new icon of London. And what it looks like is some kind of a crashed serpent rope or wormhole. Anish Kapoor, the sculptor who created it, has wormholes on the brain when you look at some of his other artwork, such as Cloudgate in Chicago, Temenos in northern England. This guy is clearly influenced by the stargate and wormhole symbolism, and of all things, for the London 2012 Olympics, he comes up with this idea of this tower, this ladder or tower that reaches into the sky, that's going to be taller than Big Ben and will become the icon of London. And what does it resemble? A wormhole. So I find that very fascinating in and of itself.
Well, that is interesting. Well, a little bit later then, William, I'm going to send you that correlation between the logo. Basically, it's 2012, but you toss around how they spell the 2012, and it turns into Zion. It's very interesting, and also incorporated into that, among many other things, of course, is the Olympic venue street names that they've chosen. Mm-hmm. And this is a piece of information that you can see an intelligent plan, I believe, behind the naming of the streets around the 2012 site plan, if you will. You have, for instance, the East Cross Road, the Eastern Cross, basically. You have things related to ley lines like Leyton. You have Leytonstone Road, Leyton Road, and then you also have Temple Mill Lane, Angel Lane. You also have Joseph's Road or Carpenter's Road. It's really interesting.
Wow.
I'll send you some of this, and you can take a look at it and see if there's anything to it, according to you.
Yeah, and then on top of that, add the mascots of the London Olympics,
yeah.
Wenlock and Mandeville, the little one-eyed alien-looking guys that come out of a rainbow. And you're thinking, okay, who's writing this script? Where are they coming up with all this symbolism? I mean, there seems to be some intention behind it, and I certainly agree with that. because it's going to be the worldwide spectacle. I mean, 52 million people are planning on going into the Yucatan in 2012, but I think that London, at least for the summer of 2012, will be the center of our universe, and I'll be certainly paying very close attention to some of the symbolism and the mythology that they'll be using at that time, and I'll bet you anything it's going to be relative to stargates and wormholes.
I think so. There seems to be a tradition throughout the opening ceremony specifically to talk about all kinds of weird stuff. I'm thinking back to the LA Olympics where they had some kind of UFO landing type thing after, I think it was the closing ceremony. You've had other things pertinent to DNA and the birth of a new child during the, I think it was the Torino Winter Olympics in Italy. Things like that. Is it because we have massive amounts of people tuning into this? So I would think that they would want to send a message, if you will, and it seems to be multi-contextual, if you will, William. So it's very interesting watching this stuff, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the Olympic parks themselves are just phenomenal exposés of the latest architecture and concepts, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they come up with in London, because I'm sure it's going to be absolutely spectacular and will undoubtedly have a message for us to decode.
You bet. And so why don't we get into a little bit here in terms of the secret of Sion? And you can obviously you've been on a path, William. You've been following on from one end point to a new beginning all the time. You've been moving forward in your work, and this is your latest one, obviously. And how does it connect with your other work? Is it moving on from a point where you left off last time, or how do you approach the latest one here, William?
In a way, The Secret of Sion is a compilation, but it also breaks some really new territory. This is a one-of-a-kind book that is a departure from anything that you see out there on this subject. The key concept behind it is that there is a tribe, a race of Stargate-traveling, time-traveling beings that ultimately, when you follow their trail, when you follow the literary trail as left in the Egyptian texts, as found in the Gnostic texts, you follow them all the way to the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And you discover that there's this belief in this literary tradition that there are what we refer to as ascended human beings, the next level of human beings who are in light body form, who have left Earth, travel via Stargator wormhole to the center of the galaxy, and come and go from that place. And one of the prerequisites for this travel is they put on what they referred to in ancient Iran as the beaming garment. The beaming garment is a transmittable garment of light. It was worn by Elijah when he ascended into the heavens in a whirlwind. It was worn by the Sumerian god Enki, the creator god of the Anunnaki. It was worn by Jesus in his transfiguration. It is passed from person to person to person and from generation to generation to generation, and its ultimate use is to transform us into light beings preparatory to going through these gateways or portals that ultimately lead to the center of the galaxy. And the reason it's so important that we look at this now is because, again, according to Maya 2012 prophecy especially, the center of our Milky Way galaxy is rising. It's rising in our awareness. We're gaining understanding of the center of the galaxy. We know more about it now than perhaps at any time in history. And what I'm saying is that there is an ancient literary tradition that discusses the center of the galaxy and tells us about advanced human beings that dwell there.
Really interesting. And there's so much to this, of course. I remember, William, back when I discovered your work in the beginning, you had a book out called The Cloak of the Illuminati. Very interesting, and it seems to pick up on this thread here that you mentioned about the beaming garment. I think in that point as well, you talked about that from the point of view of the coat of many colors that Joseph was wearing. This is the same idea, correct?
Yes, it is. The term that I chose then was the cloak or garment of light, or the cloak of the Illuminati, because when I looked up the word Illuminati in the Webster's dictionary, I found that it said it was defined as a newly baptized Christian initiate. That's one of its earliest meanings. And of course you find references to the illumined ones, the shining ones throughout the ancient world. And what I started picking up on was this thread of this idea that, well, how did these guys become illumined ones or shining ones? And what you would, what I would inevitably find is that they were almost always possessors of a garment, a cloak or garment of light that gave them extraordinary human powers and ultimately enabled them to open and travel through these gateways.
That's right. And do you think that this is something that I always had two takes on the Illuminati, if you will. We have an elite dark force that are using this terminology. They're using this veneer there, if you will, actually blinding us with the light in that sense. And then you have a real one, a true one, but what actually has to do with true enlightened beings. So there is a kind of a war or a tug going on here between these two forces. But do you think that there has been research and is research on Stargate type technology of actually trying to open, trying to access maybe this power, maybe actually through the use of some other technology that we don't know about yet, to tap into this or even transport themselves there or bring in something? What do you think, William?
Well, I'm somewhat skeptical about claims that the U.S. government or the dark or black ops people, black hats, possess Stargate technology and we're already traveling to Mars and doing all this sort of thing. And the reason why I'm skeptical is because when you look into the ancient record anyway, and mind you, things can change over a couple of thousand years.
That's right.
But when you look into the ancient record and you look into the stories of Jesus, you look into the stories of the Anunnaki, you look into the stories of any of the ancient figures that are associated with this cloak or garment of light and the ability to open and traverse these gateways, you find that the only way in the ancient world you could access these gates was to become a being of pure light and pure love. And I just don't see these black ops people as being in the business of creating beings of pure light and pure love.
Yeah.
And that is kind of the line that I draw. I'm totally open to being, to having my mind changed on this. I'm totally open to any of these people that make claims that they use this Stargate technology. Show it to me. I'm right there with you. I would love to believe that we have that capability, that we have developed this, our technology to the point where we can actually do this. But until then, I think movies like Stargate, movies like Contact, Carl Sagan was a huge disinformation agent in regards to Stargate technology. He was the one who literally invented it as a literary device. He and Kip Thorne at Caltech envisioned this device that could open stargates or wormholes. And you remember the storyline, you get this machine, the blueprint for a machine beamed to us from Lyra in the movie, the star system Lyra. What that does to me is it sets up a literary gargoyle. It sets up this scenario where individuals are disempowered because only they, these special black ops people, can have access to this technology when every single ancient spiritual tradition, the Tibetan, the Egyptian, the early Christian, the Iranian, every single one of them talks about humans being able to traverse these gateways. None of them refer to any kind of device or machine, say for the Egyptians, which we can get into and talk about the distinction, but none of them talk about an actual device that is used in order to do this. What they all do talk about is that, hey, Henrik, William, if you get your act together, if you work on and develop your spiritual potential, you can spin your body into a vortex of pure energy, dissolve it into pure light, and open a stargate or wormhole with your body and travel to other star systems. That is the clear potential that they hold. And this is why I get a little bit, angry isn't quite the right word, but just sort of skeptical, suspicious when you get people talking about Stargate technology, because again, it takes it off of your personal power and what you can do with your life and onto this idea that, hey, these guys are ripping us off. The elite have this. They've taken it from us. Let's go get it back. Well, that's bogus in my view, completely bogus, and is a total literary gargoyle. And it tells me that the person is really probably a disinformation agent for the dark side of the Illuminati.
Well, that's a good point. And I was thinking about something as well, because as I've heard you speak before, William, on both your presentations and on other programs and so forth, you were talking about this third alternative that you know, we shouldn't be stuck in left or right wing, but you're looking for a transcendent option, if you will. But it's also, it's understandable. It's a difficult time right now, because if we view this as the game of Monopoly, if you will, then currently they own our house. They've burnt down our hotels, you know, and the streets we used to own have been taken away from us now by a force of the New World Order militarized police, if you will. And not that all of this is about material stuff, but these material comforts, if you will, that we might have experienced for a while, they've ensured us to be able to focus on our spiritual life. But it seems like all of this has been robbed from us. And so how do you see that we move on from here in terms of the situation that we're in right now? Because this is a node point, and even you have the sub theme on your site, William, that it's time. You know, it's happening. It's right now. But it's a chaotic time right now as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. And I recently heard Alex Jones say that the war for human liberty against total dehumanization is on now, and I agree with him. We are facing the greatest disaster in human history. We are being dehumanized. You got all these people with their phone roaches in their ears, and you've got this tremendous fear, and as you're describing, suddenly the Constitution in America has been shredded. You've got police forces on the streets all over the planet. But nobody was messed with more than the ancient Gnostics. And they were emphatic that if you want to achieve true liberty, true power, true capacity, strength, authority, you've got to tap into what they called a hidden power that raised us from dead beings, which is what we are when we allow these forces of fear to impinge on our or infringe on our consciousness, and become living beings. And this is when they talk specifically about, look, you have got to clothe yourself in what they called the perfect light, which is equatable to this cloak of light, the garment of light, the beaming garment. Because if you can do that, these powers, who are both terrestrial and extraterrestrial, spiritual as well as flesh and blood beings, they cannot see you if you are clothed in this light. And that is why I'm encouraging people to, hey, this is the time right now, today, for you to begin working on releasing yourself from this fear. Because if you're even thinking about it, you are that fear. And it's time to unplug from that and develop yourself as a being of light and love to the greatest possible extent that you can. Because if you're not going to do it now, when are you going to do it? If you don't need motivation to do it now, what motivation will you need? And, I mean, I'm not trying to sound preachy or anything to people, but it's like, look, I don't care what Rockefeller is doing what Rothschild right now. That does not concern me, because that does not change my life one iota.
Yeah.
It does nothing for me. But what I can do is release myself and work on my own self as a spiritual being, and that will allow me to shed more light in my life and shed more light in the life of those around me as well. And that's what I'm encouraging people to do, and that's the personal choice that I'm making right now.
So at the current moment, when things are as they are, the challenge to do these things is the greatest, but also potentially the impact, if we manage them to release during a time like this, that might mean in one way or another success of this mission, if you will. But what if we break down that a little bit more, and maybe you can describe a little bit more what you're talking about, what you mean that this will be individually, obviously, different for everybody, but what would you see the processes of us going through to begin to release some of these things and let go of some of the material realms and begin to focus on our spiritual essence instead, William?
Well, let's look at it this way. We've all got, if we're lucky, 24 hours each day. And we have a choice in how we're going to spend that time. And what I encourage people to do is just to start to look at yourself as a whole being. Feed yourself mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally, is if you were trying to achieve a state of wholeness and even holiness. I mean, so much of our time is spent on, for many people that I talk with anyway, they're focused on the conspiracy. They're trying to stay up with the latest crazy information that's out there. Well, that's great because you do need some of that. You need to know what's going on in the environment. But at the same time, we can all improve our diet. We can all improve our thoughts. We can all be kinder. We can all be gentler. We can all be more patient. We can all be working towards connecting with our higher self. We can be working on just being more generous with ourselves as well as with others in our life. And what that does, it starts to set up this amazing ripple effect for ourselves as well as for everyone we come into contact with.
Absolutely. There's a lot of points here that you talk about in your latest work. And a little bit later, I want to tie in this idea again of Sion, because it seems to me, William, that also the other force that we've been talking about here a little bit later, and we don't have to get stuck on this, but I see that there's something with the rebuilding of Sion that has been happening as well on the planet. I remember a while back we talked about the district of Sion in Washington, D.C., with the writer, author, and also Freemason, Christopher Knight, about how he could see that the powers that be were trying to recreate the aspects of what he termed Sion anyway into the architecture of Washington, and obviously encoded into this, as you've been mapping with the apotheosis of Washington and everything else, this comes along with that. But do you make any distinction there? Because we got into some disturbing stuff about the war machine as well of Pentagon, and how certain of these people at a specific time in the history were planning to build a Pentagon before the breakout of World War II. We have a lot of dark stuff, if will, William, encoded into some of the magnificent symbolism that you've been looking at when it comes to the dome in Washington, D.C., and many other things. What's your view on all of this?
Well, what you put out is what you get back. I mean, what you put into it is what you get back. When I did my research on the dome of the U.S. Capitol, I wasn't poisoned by negative thinking about this. I went in fairly open-minded, taking a look at it and saying, well, okay, the dome is a symbol for a gateway, a connection point to heaven and earth. How could that possibly be bad or evil or somehow got some kind of crazy conspiracy around it? Then you go into the dome, you look up, and there's a ring of stars, 72 stars, or 72 stars in a ring, a gateway. And you've got George Washington on the rainbow. And I'm wondering, well, okay, why is Washington on the rainbow? And I start doing the research and say, well, wait a minute, that's exactly how the Christians portray the resurrected Jesus. He is always portrayed on a rainbow or in a rainbow. This is how he's described when he's enthroned. Where is the throne of Christ? Because it seems that George Washington might be sitting on that same throne. Well, when you go into the book of Hebrews, you find out that there is a holy city, a heavenly Jerusalem. It's called Sion. It's spelled with an S. It means the pure place, the perfect place. It means the place of peace. And you find out that this heavenly Jerusalem, Sion, is in fact inhabited by a company of angels, but not just angels. The book of Hebrews tells us that Sion, which is, I believe, located at the center of the galaxy, and we'll talk about how I derived that belief, Sion is actually inhabited by just humans made perfect. Who are just humans made perfect? Well, the word just means upright. It means righteous. It means balanced. Jesus' brother James was called James the Just because he was considered to be a righteous, a godly man. That doesn't mean, that's not necessarily a religious term. We all know those self-righteous people that drive us crazy. We're not talking about it in those terms. We're talking about simply a pure-hearted being. A human is, of course, a member of the species Homo sapien. It means there's no animals there. They're not fully divine beings, and they're not machines. These are just humans that dwell at Sion. They are made, which means shaped or formed, perfect. And what perfect means is compassionate. It means fully developed. It means whole or holy. So, in fact, Sion is a place that's inhabited by righteous humans who have made, shaped, or formed themselves into compassionate, fully developed, whole, and fully developed human beings. Why would anybody have a problem with that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it might be there's a lot to the terminology when one goes into the biblical
and here's
scriptures.
The problem. Here's the problem is that people are often using words that, one, they don't know the definition or the source of the words, and they assume that a word means the same thing throughout history. And word meanings change.
Yeah, they do.
Babel is a very good example of that. It originally meant the ladder, tower, or stairway to heaven. Then after the Old Testament God demolished that ladder, tower, or stairway, the Hebrew scribes changed the meaning of the word to confusion or nonsense, which is what it presently means. So there's an example of how this happens. And I just feel like what happens is people get hung up on words and don't really try to find the source material. They repeat definitions of words without doing their own research on them. But when you really look into it, you're like, well, wait a minute. Okay, so Sion is just simply a place where just humans made perfect dwell. And in fact, this is exactly what you find in the dome of the U.S. Capitol, is that Washington sitting on a rainbow is equated with Jesus sitting on a rainbow, which means that he has achieved human perfection. Washington is presented in the dome of the U.S. Capitol as a model of a person who has fully developed themselves and has achieved true liberty, true power, and true strength. He has tapped into a hidden power and has made himself a more whole or even holy human being, which to me is the goal of all of our quest. In fact, according to the Tibetans and according to the Egyptians, that's the only way we're getting out of this place, is to become more whole, holy, and complete.
Do you think that this is an attempt to deify George Washington, to make him into something he's not, or do you think that he's at this stage when Brumidi, I think it was, who painted
Constantino
this,
Brumidi, that's yeah. Right, yeah.
Did he want to try use George Washington at this point as a symbol for something greater, something higher? What do you think?
Well, I think there was a belief during Washington's lifetime that he was an extraordinarily special person, a man of destiny. There was a belief in the immediate aftermath of his death, as evidenced by the artwork, and I've collected this and it's in my book, Freedom's Gate. This artwork shows Washington ascending into the heavens. And so we don't have that belief today. I mean, sometime after the Civil War or so in America, 1865, 1870 is when this belief starts to go away. But at that time, from, say, 1793 up until the Civil War, 1865, there was a widely held belief that Washington did ascend, that he was this extremely special human being. And there was also a belief that you, too, could become one of these special otherworldly beings, and you could join Washington in Sion with the other righteous members of the human race who have fully developed themselves and become whole or holy beings.
Tell us a little bit about how you think that some of these artists, we have Brumidi, but there's a number of other ones as well. You've dug out some interesting artwork all across the board that are, you know, have a relationship to one way or another to some of the themes and motifs that you mentioned in terms of the Stargate. You have rainbows, other things. Where did they get the knowledge from this from? Was this through the creative forces, or were they in tune with something else? What do you think, William?
Well, that's a really fascinating question. And in The Secret of Sion, I have a very large collection of ascension art. I mean, part of the point of the book was to show that ascension isn't just a Christian concept. It's not just an Egyptian concept or Tibetan. In fact, these cultures all share a base tradition that was brought here by beings not from this world, and this belief that there is this super advanced race of, call them extraterrestrials, call them advanced beings, who travel the stars not through slow-moving, clunky flying saucers, but rather through interdimensional portals and wormholes. And across the board, across cultures, when you see these beings being presented, for example, I'll just talk about the ascension of Jesus. When Jesus is portrayed ascending into the heavens, he's being carried aloft in a winged ring, a ring composed of concentric rings, often filled with stars, that is being carried into the heavens by angels. when we look at that from the early 21st century perspective, we look at that artwork and go, okay, so a concentric rings filled with stars, that's what we today call a stargate. And then you flip over to ancient Iran, to Ahura Mazda, a god who flies around on a winged ring and holds in his hand his chakra of power, or which is called the Ring of Cosmic Sovereignty. And what you realize is that, wait a minute, there is a whole other group of beings out here who have developed themselves and who actually travel the stars through these gateways or portals. And I really like the term the beaming garment for the garment of light that these guys wear. I mean, again, it's called the robe of glory, the cloak of light, the cloak of many colors, the rainbow body. There are numerous names for it, but I settled on the term the beaming garment, which again comes from ancient Iran, because when they put on this garment, they radiate light. They literally beam. They radiate light or energy. And then they also, according to these stories, have the ability to beam, using now the Star Trek meaning of the term, from point A to point B. So they put on this beaming garment, they radiate light, then they beam through these gateways. And this is borne out in the story of Jesus. I mean, after the resurrection, he appears to the Apostle Paul in a flash. Well, how else are we to interpret this except that he is an illuminated being, a being of light? In the Gnostic tradition, we find numerous references to Jesus appearing to the disciples after the crucifixion and ascension. And whenever he appears, there's a notation that the heavens opened, and then Jesus was standing before me as a being of light. Today, we don't talk about the heavens opening. We talk about stargates and wormholes. And it's clear to me that what's happening here is that he is one of these fully developed humans who can flash, beam through the universe. And he's just one of a part of a tribe, if you will, of these advanced avatars that have this capability. They are still here, and they are attempting to get us to wake up to this reality and to begin to put some focus on ourselves to join this tribe.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. In the meantime, it feels like we and maybe many others, you know, specifically I think of the elite as well, have maybe gotten stuck on this idea that it's a material thing, that they're trying to physically open this with a machine or with some kind of really powerful tool, if you know what I mean. Do you think that we're deluding ourselves a little bit? We're not getting the whole picture here, basically.
I think so, but I'm here and willing to be shown differently. Please take me and show me this machine. I've done research on the particle accelerator at CERN.
Yeah.
I know that there are Russian scientists, mathematicians that say they're building a time travel machine there, a teleportation device. The physicists at CERN actually say that. And I'm thinking, well, that's a very good possibility. But what I'm saying is that based on the research that I've done into the ancient world and the existence of these gateways and beings that have been coming and going virtually since the beginning of recorded history, they never did so with a machine. What they did, though, is they had this transformative teaching that anybody could tap into that would enable them to put on the beaming garment and beam themselves.
In a way, that means that the body is the machine or the tool
the body
that we can use.
Is absolutely the machine, and that's the diversion to me.
Yeah.
Because if you're looking for a machine out here, I mean, everybody's looking for the Ark of the Covenant. Where's the Ark of the Covenant? Is it in Ethiopia, or is it, where is it?
Mm.
Well, according to this tradition, the Ark of the Covenant is your first three chakras. And the reason why archaeologists can never find the Ark of the Covenant is because they're always sitting on it. And I mean, that's the old joke, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, the gods got together. They have this secret. They want to hide this secret from humanity. Should we bury it in the ocean? No, they'll create a submarine. They'll be able to find it. Well, let's put it up high on the mountain. Oh, no, they'll be able to climb that mountain. Well, we should bury it out in the desert. No, someone will find it. Oh, I know. Let's put it inside them. They'll never think to look there.
Well, and that's a really, from their point of view, that's a really good strategy, isn't it, to confuse and, in that sense, occupy your mind with other things and also at the same time claiming that things that are pertinent to looking into your own spiritual self down to certain divination tools, if you will, astrology and things like that, are really on an external way frowned upon, but then I believe that they are using these tools themselves to try to get closer to something, whatever, you know, they're actually searching for, William. But in that sense, it's a clever strategy. And I mean, how did humanity end up in the dark ages, if you know what I mean, when we allegedly had such great and vast knowledge in the past, and all of a sudden things are just going incredibly downhill? You know, it's a mystery to me. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, well, I always like to point to, there was an invention by an anonymous Italian inventor that freaked out the Vatican in the Middle Ages, and that invention was eyeglasses. And the reason why the church freaked out is because with it came the idea that we were improvable, that we didn't have to just simply live with whatever our present circumstance was, that the human body is improvable. And the church is like, God's work is infallible. How dare you say that? And that's kind of been the battle all along, is the question is, can we in fact improve ourselves? And you've got the forces that, well, I mean, going back to the Anunnaki, wasn't that the whole battle between Enki and Enlil? Enki wanted to see us to, he wanted to raise us to the level of the Anunnaki in terms of our capability and even to exceed the Anunnaki. Enlil wanted to keep us at the level of slaves and sex objects, deaf, dumb, and blind, stupid, down on the farm, plantation workers, right?
Yeah.
Which is what still most of the planet is. And what we're challenged with doing is extracting ourselves from that matrix and beginning to plug ourselves into this idea that, wait a minute, I'm in a people phase here. We're like the cocoons that are in the process of morphing into the butterfly. I want to go find the butterflies. Show me this model of the next evolved human, because I want to join those guys. I'm sick of crawling around here on the ground as a little caterpillar. I know that what's inside of me is something truly magnificent. And I'm going to take my energy and emotion and focus on releasing that magnificence and follow those guys. And that's what I did in The Secret of Sion, is to say, wait a minute, there's a whole race or tribe of these human beings that have been coming here forever. And they all say the same thing, that we all have this capability within us, and we have got to put ourselves on the path towards awakening that potential. And that, to me, is what this time is about. And I'm very concerned that we don't have a lot of time to be able to do this. I mean, if Ray Kurzweil and some of these singularity theorists are right, we've got less than 25 years, because 25 years from now, we're all going to be, 60% of us are going to be living in cities. We're going to be wired up to a grid. We're going to have the implants in our eyes. We're going to have the new tattoo computers put in our skin. And we're going to be cyborgs. And in my opinion, I don't think a cyborg is going to be in the position to achieve the beaming garment, the garment of light, as like a person without these implants will be able to do. And this is my concern at this time.
So when some people see this as an upgrade, human 2.0, you see it as a downgrade, actually.
I see it as a prison. I see it absolutely as a trap, as a prison, as just about the last thing that we really want to do. I mean, according to the Gnostics, anyway, their perspective is, I mean, the baseline story for the Stargate wormhole theory and awakening this light body, the beaming garment, is in the story of Adam and Eve. After Eve takes of the fruit of knowledge, the wisdom of the serpent, the Old Testament God Yahweh, who probably equates with Enlil, evicts Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden and does two things. One, creates a gate at the east of Eden, puts a flaming sword in the center of the gate and cherubim on either side, and forbids humankind to re-enter that gate, setting up the whole Stargate metaphor that we're searching for this gate, trying to get back through it. And the second thing he does is what most Judeo-Christians have forgotten about. Yahweh made coats of skin for humanity. Now, the traditional teaching says, oh, those were animal skins. But the esoteric Jewish tradition says, no. When Adam and Eve were in the garden originally, when humanity as a whole were originally in the garden, we were beings of light. And then were put into, or given our coats of skin. So in a way, our whole job, and the Tibetans teach this exact same thing, our whole job of Earth life, our mission, our spiritual mission is to transcend the skin, to move beyond it. And what I see with the tattoos, the computer tattoos, the implants and all that, is that that is just a further entrapment in our skin. What we have to do is just recognize, wait a minute, there's actually a being of light that is within us, and we need to take off the human skin and put on our garment of light once again in order to exit this world.
This is very interesting. Obviously, William, we have much more to discuss. We're going to carry on here a little bit later in the next segment. I want to ask you some more things pertinent both to your book but also your DVD. In the meantime here, though, as we wrap things up with the first hour, WilliamHenry.net, that's the website that we urge our listeners to go to find out more, obviously, about your work, about you have all your titles and things up there as well. And let's just talk briefly about the latest book and the latest DVD. I guess they go kind of hand in hand. I've seen some excerpts from the DVD, William, and it's really really well done in that sense, and it gives also a visual complement, if you will, to the book, correct?
Yes, it does. The book has got over 100 images I've collected from various museums around the world that show this ascension art, that shows this ancient, I call it Stargate art, because it's always referencing the idea of the gateway and the transformation that is required to go through that gateway. So the book itself is a wonderful picture book, but when you put the Gnostic text with it as the narrative, it paints this very clear and, I think, compelling picture that there is this advanced race of beings who have transformed themselves into light beings who dwell at the center of the galaxy, and they are coming and going. And if Maya prophecy, 2012 prophecy, is right, especially concerning the return of Quetzalcoatl, we're talking about the manifestation of these beings in 2012. That's the part of one of the conclusions in the book, is that Quetzalcoatl is a representative of this tribe of beings.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, we're going to talk more about that here in the next segment, obviously, as well. Again, the title of the book here is The Secret of Sion, Jesus Stargate, the Beaming Garment, and the Galactic Core in Ascension Art. And then we have the DVD with the title The Light of Sion. What would you do if you weren't afraid? I like that subtitle, by the way. it's a really good one. WilliamHenry.net, that's the website. Stay with us, William. We'll continue talking more after this show.
Oh,
In the second hour, we discuss the dwellers of Zion and if they will return in 2012. William mentions the return of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, and how he might have been a seraphim from the highest order of angels. He also brings up the serpent in the Garden of Eden and how serpent symbolism has been demonized. We discuss how lines blur in mythology as well as interpretations of what is light and dark, good and bad, etc. Then we get into the motivations of the remnant survivors dwelling in the center of the galaxy, which William says are on a rescue mission. We talk about the possible cosmic reset event as a saving grace from our creator before we head down the path of a transhuman cyborg way of life. William also tells us which texts he pulls from to create the basis for the secret of Zion. Later we talk about Zion versus Zion with a C, and not from the conspiratorial viewpoint of rebuilding Solomon's temple, but instead from the transformation aspect of becoming pure beings. Our first hour is always free, and we have a year available for you to download or stream, and you are spared from commercial breaks. We have a member section, and when you subscribe to our website, redeyescreations.com, you get full access to all our material going back to 2006. So when you want to hear more, listen to all the programs, or the full 2 hours, consider signing up for a membership. 3 months for 15 euros. That's just 5 euros per month. It's really simple and easy. RedEyesCreations.com. Go there to log in or subscribe to continue listening to this program or any of our previous ones. We have some great guests queued up for you to kick off 2012, like James Corbett on Fukushima and ClimateGate 2.0, Shannon Dory on the Dogon and the Pneumo, Colin Andrews on Crop Circles and UFOs, Anthony Peake on Out-of-Body Experiences, Mac Maloney on UFOs in Wartime, Troy McLaughlin on the Saturn Death Cult. I think that's going to be a really interesting one. And then we also have Carl Munk, Jeff Hilling, Bob Frisell, and Shari S. following that. You're welcome to tune in again when we'll be back with more in just a few days. But stay tuned now as we continue with Hour 2 with William Henrich.